The local dive bar scene has really been dropping lately, huh?
Yeah, you're right. It has been.
Mm-hmm. That was all I had to say. Anyway, today, welcome to the Movie Vault again. I hope you've been listening to many of our episodes in the past. This is our 99th episode. We have come very far. We have some special surprises for our 100th episode, which is obviously coming out next.
It's going to be a big project. We'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, I don't know how long it'll take us. Hopefully not another 3 months.
No, hopefully not that long.
Yeah. So I almost forgot, which is fitting. Today's movie is called Memento, which came out in 2001. It's rated R, and it's 113 minutes. It's pretty short. And we kind of lied. I think we said in the last episode that we were going to do Killers of the Flower Moon, because I think I mentioned we were doing two.
And we were really excited to do that.
And it didn't work out.
Yeah.
Just technicalities.
Yeah. I tried to find tickets, and I was pretty sure that it was out of the theaters, which led me to believe that, okay, they put it on Apple TV, so they made a shorter theater run. Maybe I was too impatient with the ticket process, and they actually did have showings. But for whatever reason, we wanted to watch the movie in the worst period of time, where it was like out of theaters, but not yet on Apple TV, which is like a really bad deal for us. But hopefully we'll get that in like episode 101 or 102 or something like that.
Yeah, hopefully we'll find our groove then.
Yeah.
You know, it's about time.
We're still looking for it.
Are we past 3 years of doing this or no?
Yes, okay. We are.
Nice.
We are.
Well, great. So yeah, Memento, it's probably what, our fourth or fifth Christopher Nolan film that we've done on this podcast?
Yeah, we've done Interstellar.
Tenet. Have we done Inception?
We have not done Inception. We've done Oppenheimer.
Oh, yeah. I forget that's because it's so different.
It's so new, and it's actually, we didn't do that one too long ago, really, as far as episode numbers go. So a lot of Nolan lately.
Yeah, maybe we should take a break after this.
We have not done The Dark Knight.
None of the trilogy.
We have not done Inception. It would be an interesting one. Really, any of his movies would be interesting to do. Even Following, I watched this, his first movie.
Oh, really?
And that's
hard to find, right?
No, well, actually, it's been coming on more things. I think I watched it on Tubi. So,
Do you pay for Tubi?
No, Tubi's free.
Oh.
Yeah, with ads though.
And okay, well, never mind. You know what's interesting is if we were to do Inception, I don't know. I'd have to swallow some kind of pill, because not like literally. I meant like metaphorically. Because it's just the movie that everybody asks if I've done, and I'd want to say no, because it's like, then I can tell people we actually watch movies that are in my, you know, that I prefer,
right?
Rather than Inception, because people always, that's the movie that I've been asked the most, have we done
Inception? Which it's interesting, because I did also watch it pretty early on, and though when I really got into movies, it's like it's sort of like that gateway into movies, but it's also like it's like a crossroads. Trying to come up, or a fork in the road, whatever you want to call it, where you can take one direction where you just like really dive deep and you get way past Inception in terms of like your love of cinema, and then there's another road where you kind of just like plateau at that level.
That's forever. Like, that's very true. There is no one, there is no in between.
No, it's sort of like your Matrix red pill or blue pill moment.
That is interesting, because you'll have your movie buffs, you know, self-proclaimed,
right,
that are usually the plateauers, the ones that are into the Inceptions or the, I don't know, what other movie, the Wes Anderson films.
Wes Anderson. I'm trying to think of like what the surface level.
The most. I mean,
you think you're pretentious, but you're actually not.
Yeah. The real people who are actually pretentious about it wouldn't display that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I think people, a mark of people who are a little bit more pretentious about things is that they're actually a little bit more restrained. So if you try not, but I think a lot, Christopher Nolan does encapsulate a lot of like what people like, or I mean, it sort of gets lumped into the like film bro genre, like Fight Club, movies that have a lot of like aha moments or like big plot twists get thrown in,
Good
like
Will
Prisoners,
Hunting.
Good Will Hunting, yeah. movies in the IMDb top 200, although there's a lot of like foreign and older movies in that list, but.
And those are good movies.
Yeah, they're good movies.
It's just tough, because I think of the true heroes of the film critic culture, none of them have Letterboxd. And it's just this Letterboxd community.
Yeah, that's true.
That whole, and I'm on Letterboxd. I'm not.
I love Letterboxd, but you're right.
But the people who I admire the most in the movie world are people who are so beyond what I think. Like, and I'm going to say his name. No, I'm not going to say his name. But another example might be Roger Ebert or someone like that, who's in that realm. And I watched The Big Picture, or I listened to it, and Sean Fennessy is also one of my movie heroes right now. He's more pop culture-y, and he's very much into these cheap movies, but his breadth of movies is very wide.
Yeah, he does have a
really insane. Amanda Dobbins. But Amanda Dobbins might be in that realm of not in Letterboxd, because she's not. But I was going to say Quentin Tarantino, and I just ruined our streak. I can't not bring him up, because when I think of him, he has every single scene he's made, he has like a list of 30 films that have influenced it.
Right.
And that's true movie watching. Even movies that you don't necessarily love, he's found a way to integrate them.
Yeah, I think maybe also it's not just being a really good film viewer, which is a weird thing to say, because like, what makes you good at watching something? And maybe it is what you take away, what you do with it once you've watched it, that really drives whether or not you got something out of the experience. But are they're just really confident individuals who can like, they know that they like a movie, and they're not necessarily taking it in as much of what other people think about it, right? I mean, it's a very difficult line, especially, and it's much more difficult now than it ever has been before, because we literally have like aggregating systems that, like, even Letterboxd is kind of like, it's, I guess it's not an aggregate, but it's still, you're looking at an average of how many people like this movie. Mm-hmm. So like when something's rated highly on Letterboxd, you're like, can I not like this movie? Because like most people like it.
And then
you'll get something and you'll be like, oh, I like this movie, but it only got like a, I don't even know what a bad score on Letterboxd
you're
is
right,
exactly,
you're
but
right.
like a 3.1 or something.
And don't even get me started on Rotten Tomatoes. But yeah. This is how I think of it. The movie culture, every movie in the world is the Amazon rainforest, not the company. And there are paths that have been tread by different people. And you know, it's sort of like what you said, the fork in the road, whether you plateau or you go more specific, different niche movies. And every path that each person goes on, they're treading a little bit. Sometimes they're following other paths. And the true movie heroes that I can think of have treaded so many different paths that they have created so many different paths. Mm-hmm. And they've been in so many different areas of the rainforest, and they mapped it out. And they can understand different routes. You know, they understand specific places. They understand, and this is, you know, equating to genre, directors, actors, different ways that cameras are positioned. And everyone's route is unique, but some paths are the same, right?
Right.
Like I might go on path A and B in a day, and someone might go and B to A in one day. We're still on the same paths, just in different orders. Or I might create my own path and go into a niche area that few people have been in and shed light on that genre of film or something like that. Some of my movie heroes have just been, they live in the rainforest and they're just there all the time. I only have time to go in there a little bit, right?
Right.
After school. And I love the rainforest, and I can love the smells. I love the different areas of it, and the, you know, the people that I meet along the way, and you know, the heroes, the people at the different citadels of the different areas of the rainforest. You know, all your big directors. But I also love to go in the caves and the most cornermost part of it, and just find someone that I've never heard of, that nobody, only four people have ever heard of, and I just like to be in that culture too. So it's like the range of it is amazing too. That's how I think of people's moving. I call it movie aura.
Yeah,
your movie aura is where you've been and in what order you've been in.
Yeah, that's true, because you can definitely trace back, like this led to this, led to this. But sometimes it's a little bit more sporadic, like, oh, I jumped into this, like I swam through the river and I found a shortcut to this other place, and I had to backtrack to like figure out where that came from.
But those who plateau are the ones that are just sticking on the main paths that are the famous paths.
Yeah. And maybe they'll kind of get there, but it's like a slower, much slower progression.
Yeah, and those paths are really wide because so many people have stepped on them.
Yeah.
And they love to bring their friends, and they're the people that bring campers to camping and bring the heating mattresses and everything. And the people who are, you know, maybe aren't the ones plateauing are the ones that are climbing cliffs, you know. I think of the movie Free Solo, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, it doesn't mean one's better than the other.
No, it doesn't. I mean, at the end of the day, movies are a subjective thing, and so is the Amazon rainforest. So
sure.
If you're happy on your path, then
yeah,
nobody can tell you otherwise.
But someone who might have been on this path and not be able to remember what their movie aura might be is, what's his name? Junior? I forget his name. Junior Sammy? No, it's not him. That's Guy Pearce's Leonard. I'm looking at the wrong name.
Oh, you're looking at Sammy Jenkins.
Yeah, Sammy Jenkins. Even though, spoiler, we'll get to that part. And Leonard wouldn't be able to remember where he's been or what he's done up to a certain point. He'll just keep forgetting.
That's true. He doesn't know his movie aura.
Yeah. So Roger Ebert says it pretty well. He says it's kind of this narrative told backwards. It actually, Roger goes into the history of it saying the first film to kind of be used in this backward storytelling way is the film Betrayal in 1983, which is based on a play. And Christopher Nolan kind of uses this strategy, but with a little twist. And he kind of, what he does is, this guy has no ability to form short-term memory. So what he does is he has all of these memories up until a certain point, an incident where his head gets smashed into a pane of glass in his bathroom. Because this guy had come in and done things to his wife and, supposedly had killed her. And the movie, the story, the device that's used in this film is that the movie is being told backwards with interim scenes of him in a bedroom on the phone talking to someone, kind of explaining the plot in different ways.
So it's in the colored sequences, this story is being told backwards. And the way that they kind of trick around doing that is they just start the scene further back and end the scene earlier every time. That's the strategy. Because obviously it wouldn't make sense if you actually were just running it backwards. Mm-hmm. So they can kind of use some filmmaking tricks to make it work that they're actually filming the or showing the movie it backwards. But then in the black and white scene where he's talking to somebody on the phone, that's in chronological order.
Yes.
And then eventually the two meet in the middle,
and so then color is used to tell the rest of the story.
Yeah, so it's I don't know what you would call it. What's the shape for that? It would make like a
circle.
Oh, that's not a circle.
A hyperbola.
Maybe it's a hyperbola.
Is that like a U sideways?
Yeah, U sideways. That's a hyperbola. Hyperbola. Yes.
So, R.E. says Memento is kind of this diabolical, absorbing experience where Pierce kind of he plays this. Low-rent fugitive who kind of makes these maps, jots notes, and explains over and over that he has to talk fast because in a few minutes he'll start forgetting the conversation. And he explains that like 42 times in this. And a motel clerk takes advantage of him and makes him pay for two rooms at the same time. Tells him he admits that he's frauding him, but he points out that he'll forget it. So
yeah, several people tell them how they're like ripping him off or like taking advantage of him, but they're like, you're not gonna be able to do anything about it, man. Sorry.
And that's like the one of the main points of the plot is like this guy's memory is getting twisted by these people who are really knowing how to mess up his plan because they know his systems, because he's pretty open about his systems. You know, he gets tattoos, he writes
he loves his systems,
and his systems are terrible. We'll get into that. And so the line is, even if you get revenge, you're not going to remember it. He's told at one point, but his reply always has this certain logic that kind of goes, my wife deserves revenge whether I remember it or not. A striking thing about this is that in these series of flashbacks, Leonard is kind of investigated as well, where he works for this insurance company and involves a man named Sammy, who appears to have the same type of memory loss, and that's being talked about throughout the entire film. And otherwise, he seems like this regular good guy, Sammy. But his wife, who is diabetic, can't be sure if he's faking or not. And she arranges this test to kind of see if he's faking. And the story has relevance to Leonard's life, but in an indirect way, but maybe in a more direct way as we find out. We come to further in the story when different people are involved in kind of tricking him along the way, such as Teddy or Natalie, and even Bert is the clerk. And these people are kind of twisting the narrative a little bit along the way so that when he regains these memories in the morning, every morning, after he forgets everything that's happened up until the accident, he has to look at his tattoos and follow the logic, follow the facts of the lists that he has on his body and in his notes. I mean, that would just be a weird experience, by the way. I'm just thinking.
Every single time you wake up, John G. raped and murdered my wife.
Yeah.
And every time that's a huge reveal to you. Like, every single time. Mm-hmm. That's, yeah.
And I'm wondering, like, every day he's probably got to find out at different times. There might be some day when he finds out, like, at 8 p.m. and he's about to go to bed. He's like, what is going on? And then goes to bed and then has to remember it. So many days are probably wasted if you think about it.
Yeah, that's true. If you think about it, like, obviously, maybe are we too early to get in? We're not too early. There's definitely holes in the idea that this could actually happen. I think the impressive thing is that Nolan is able to make us believe, at least to an extent, that this could actually happen to somebody and that the system could work to the extent that it's working in this movie. Because, I mean, I don't know much about anterograde amnesia, but I'm guessing, I don't know how many people, whether how much of a real thing it actually is.
Well, it as far as it is in the scientific realm, it's in the DSM.
It is in the DSM,
but okay. It's also, it was on my MCAT, so it must be
partially real.
The only thing that gets me though is how does he remember he has anterograde memory loss?
Yes,
and how does he remember?
Well,
that?
he says he remembers everything before the accident,
but he must have figured out that he has this memory loss condition after the accident.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know. Does he like make it, or is it just intuitive because he wakes up, he remembers that he was in an accident, and that. But he explains it the same way. It's almost like one of the holes you could maybe point out in it is it almost seems like there are certain things that he's picked up after the accident that he has like a excuse me, he has like a muscle memory of, I know he's like reacting to things as they happen.
Well, he in mentioned a lot of that scenes, he has to,
but it's like it's so he quickly picks up on what's going on. It's almost too quick.
Maybe.
There's some gunshots
going on outside.
What's going on in Medallion?
It's cool that, well, it's weird actually that he has those instincts because he eventually tries to play off of these instincts rather than memory, right? He says it's a psychological thing when he's talking about Sammy's condition because he was the guy that was involved in his case. And it wasn't a memory thing. His brain should have had the ability to develop new memories. He was just either faking it or it was the psychology that he couldn't snap out of. It was just this thing that he's stuck in, which happens. You know, people have different psychological issues that they can't get out of. But it's such an interesting concept to me because is memory physical or is it stored in our brains or is it this innate thing that's biological? Because there can be memory. There's memory in our bodies outside of our typical things that we think of that remember things in our brains, right? Our neurons.
Right.
And we don't fully understand how that works, by the way. But we have these instincts, right? And they come from the brain. Like the signals come from the brain, from the different reflexory, neurons and stuff like that, the motor neurons and different things that are involved in that pathway. But I'm just thinking, how could this guy come up with that every single day and then keep building his ideas based off of that? That's a plot hole to me, is that it seems like the only way to know that is if you had been studying that or building off of that. Because we had seen him wake up that morning and then by that afternoon he knew how his brain worked. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
So and somehow
it's like
these
he had gone through
there.
Several phases of like losing his memory, but it's like he still was building.
Okay, yes, exactly.
That's what it felt like, yeah.
So there were some plot holes. I mean, those aside, it was still a pretty good structured story that made sense to me in a story manner. But yeah, it was also a creative way to tell the story was through these, you know, quote unquote mementos that Leonard uses, tattoos, photo, you know, these Polaroids that have written things on them. Very vaguely written things, I will say. I would have written down, I think the solution to this is having a journal where you explain every single detail and then every morning you just read that journal and you don't tell anyone about it, nobody. And you spend an hour every single night before you go to bed writing down everything you just did previously to that. And that's the only way that you can get through it because his problem was he would write down these things that are so vague and he can't understand what he was actually meaning by them. For example, he had this one Polaroid that said, "Don't trust his lies," right? And he wrote that down, not knowing what that meant. So then every morning he had to remember, should I trust this guy or not? And it was a big debacle. He didn't know. So is that stupid?
Yeah, no, here's the thing. I agree with you, but my theory is that Leonard didn't want to write that specific of stuff.
That one specifically, sure. But why in general not?
I think it has to do with how you interpret, well, I guess the middle of the movie.
Okay.
Or the end of the movie.
We'll get into that. Go for it.
Yeah. It's like you wonder whether, you realize that he's being used by Sammy. Is that, no, it's not Sammy. Teddy. He's being used by Teddy, but then you wonder how much he's manipulating his own self to like perpetrate the same thing that Teddy's having him do. Because from the looks of it, Teddy's a bad cop who, it's hard to even tell who he's associated with. Is he an actual cop? Like,
he seemed to have a badge.
He said they keep going around to different places and like catching these people. But
yeah, but
like,
why does Teddy want?
But
they never explain why he's just going around killing people.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of things that aren't explained. But then you're like, does Leonard actually want any of this to end? You know, like, well, it seems like at the end of the movie when he frames Teddy to kill him, that maybe he does want it to end. But how many times does he like realize that what Teddy's doing and not do something about it before he decides to actually kill
You're right.
Kill
if there
Teddy.
Had been multiple times, there had been times when he could have written something down to stop the whole process.
Yeah.
Unless Teddy had stopped him from doing that.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I could think
Teddy
of.
But Teddy looks like an idiot at the end of the movie, if that's the case, because he should have been... Teddy should never have been in a position where Lenny was going to kill him. He should have known how to keep him from doing that.
I think it was Walter White at the dinner table saying, maybe I am Heisenberg. I think it was, he's done this a million times. He's confident. So he's
he thinks he knows Lenny too well, maybe.
Yeah, I think that might be the case. The only thing that pushed Lenny over the edge is like, I think within that day, what Leonard had remembered that day seemed to be a little bit more stressful, and he'd been in a higher tense situation than he was the previous times, which led him to have that violent reaction. Another cool, interesting thing was Natalie's character's manipulations, where she would literally walk into a room, explain that she wanted Teddy to kill a guy for him, right? And then Teddy would refuse, and then she'll say, okay, well, and then he punches her because she's like making, you know, trying to get into his head and stuff like that. She walks out of the room, goes to her car, sits there for 5 seconds, walks back in and says that someone else hit her, and then she needs help. And that's just an amazing scene. I love the whole entire thing. And it's just how easy it is for Leonard to be taken advantage of. And Leonard never accounts for that in any of his systems.
Yeah, because Natalie seems really bipolar to us as the viewer, but she realizes that she can walk in and be a new person to Lenny. Like, one scene, she's like a jerk, like goes off on him. I mean, I didn't realize the length of the language that that Nolan used. He did so actually. Following also had quite strong language as well. But you're like, wow, it's like one of those scenes where the character keeps doubling down on what they're saying, and they just keep going. Mm-hmm. And it's like there's a point where you're like, okay, they can stop now, and they just don't stop.
Yes, yes,
and. But for Lenny, he's just going to forget about it. So she can go in and be all sweet to him and then, like, presumably have sex at some point.
Yeah.
So it's like she's using him for all kinds of different things.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously Lenny has some responsibility in all of this, but he can very easily be manipulated and let himself be manipulated to an extent.
I don't get Natalie's motive.
She's probably just in bad situations in general with Jimmy. And maybe this is just like her way out. Like, okay. I don't know. Does she want Jimmy to die? Or does she want... I don't know what she
my
wants.
My impression...
Exactly.
So Jimmy was the guy in her life, right?
Yeah.
And my impression was that she wanted him gone because that was her first proposal to Lenny.
Which... And then Lenny does kill him.
Eventually when
she
fakes his abuse.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if she wanted him gone because she wanted... Whatever the money was in that
trunk.
Well,
it might have been the money, but then Teddy says he's splitting the money. Like,
Teddy said that, but I'm wondering if Natalie.
But Teddy doesn't have to follow through on anything he says to Lenny. Lenny doesn't have to know about the money as soon as he forgets. That's the thing.
Yeah, nobody has to tell the truth at all. Which that would be so nice.
Yeah, that's true. As long as they can keep themselves from getting killed by Lenny, which is ultimately what does them in.
I mean, it would be weird just having someone that you see every single day and you're having to reintroduce yourself. And you could every single day, you could just find a better tactic to work that works. You know, you try something out one day, it doesn't work. He goes to bed. The next day, you can try out something else and see if it works. It's really just this trial and error process. And I'm sure Teddy got it down pretty well, which is surprising why he messed up in the end. And Lenny got in a position where he could kill him. Maybe it was cockiness.
I have to be really, I said something very wrong. Not only is anterograde amnesia an actual thing, but many medical experts have apparently cited Memento as one of the more realistic and accurate portrayals of anterograde amnesia, including neuroscientist Christoph Koch, or something like
is
that.
Is it KOCH?
KOCH, cool. Yeah. So that would be interesting to look into. Because for some reason, maybe I just heard somewhere that, or maybe people just can't believe that something like this is real. It's not something you see commonly.
You went to fakenews.com?
Yeah. Yeah, I was probably listening to another podcast of people who had no idea anything about medicine and were just like, oh, there's no way that's real.
I mean, that's us right now.
Yeah, maybe. Exactly.
But no, it's definitely a real thing. I don't know anyone affected by it. I've never even heard of practical application.
I was kind
of
looking at like what the causes are briefly, and one of them is alcohol intoxication, which you wonder whether that's like you get super hammered and you black out and you forget what happened. That's not a recurring thing.
Lenny also said that. He said that alcohol abuse is another way.
Well, I guess it could be recurring depending on how many times you abuse alcohol.
Yeah. And I've never met anyone that's been affected by this, but if Kaplan has it in their MCAT textbooks, I must believe it's true. I don't know. And if I learned it for nothing, then it's kind of annoying. And if I've learned so many things on the MCAT for nothing, which I have, then that's annoying. But these are some interesting things. So we kind of got the plot down. That's basically all that's really happening. It's a short film. But what do you think its central theme in this was? It's kind of a hard thing to pick apart, and maybe it's just a story.
Because you get so blinded by the like structure, which happens in a lot of Nolan movies, that sometimes it's hard to pin down the actual meaning. I think we've kind of been talking about it. It's about like, what if you can't trust yourself? I think it's something like that. It's like, he's so confident in everything he's writing, but then Teddy tells him the story about how Sammy Jenkins didn't even exist, and he's Sammy Jenkins. He's the one who killed his wife with the insulin. There wasn't even an accident. Teddy could have been completely BSing that story, or he could have been telling him the actual truth.
Yeah.
And he couldn't live with this, that happened, and he created this whole fictional story. So, and that is the ambiguity that we always like to talk about. We don't know the root because we can't trust any of the characters because they all have motives to lie to us.
Yes, and that's something that I've been accustomed to over the years, ambiguity. I think it's the unreliable narrator trope with a twist, where there's also a delivery method of the story being told backwards, which is anterograde maybe. But it's nice, I mean, as an audience, someone watching this, you kind of get the gist of the film about halfway through. I could probably figure out, you know, Sammy and Lenny are probably either the same person or he was in that same scenario that Sammy was in. So it's not like this big reveal because Nolan really sticks to the structure of the film, whether it's delayed gratification or not, or whether it's you already get the idea halfway through or not. He really, and that's in all of his films, he really sticks to the structure, he sticks to the equation that's been set forth. I really appreciated that he kept going through with it and there wasn't some stupid twist at the end. And the twist was predictable, but it was good. I think it was well earned, and I think the theme of the film is just these two tropes and delivery methods of telling a story. I really think that's it. I don't think there's anything, I don't want to say that there's anything deeper than that. Maybe there is that I don't know. Roger Ebert didn't seem to say so, so I feel fine saying that there's not. But another thing is, this is just Nolan's style. This is like early Nolan. This is someone that has created films that are these great masterpieces, publicly acclaimed, because they are just movies that really stick to their concept really well. And so does this. It's not necessarily showing a nuance to society.
No. I mean, it's not even really showing who can really truly relate to any of these characters. Like, this world is so strange if you actually think about it. Like, there's this guy who's just camping out in a hotel. There's these drug deals. The stakes are, like, so hard to get a grip of what's happening and what matters. Like, are these they said there was, like, $200 million in the car. So, allegedly, these are
$200,000.
Okay. Yeah. That's a little different. Well, 200 million is like, I don't know why I thought 200.
In a trunk with dollar bills.
Yeah. Yeah. So these could just kind of be like low level criminals. And all of this stuff is kind of just like it's just like a noir movie that, like, if there was nothing different about it, it would be a super boring movie. Like, if there was no anterograde amnesia, of course it wouldn't be a Memento then. And there wouldn't be like half of the stuff in the movie. But if you just tried to make a straightforward movie where there's just like loner who comes into Nevada and there's a drug deal and they're trying to bust it. Like, how many movies are there that are already like that? Like
Drive.
You have to do something that makes it different and also makes the audience forget how like inconsequential all of these characters are to the world.
Yeah, exactly. I always think Nolan's like this what if guy. What if someone had anterograde amnesia?
Yeah.
What if people could incept each other, ideas into each other's minds? What if we could space travel? Like,
yeah,
like
what if we could change things with a time travel machine or whatever in Tenet?
Yeah, or what if some guy had this, the power of the atomic bomb and blew up Hiroshima and Nagasaki? What if?
What if that?
Yeah.
That'd be crazy.
So a lot of these what if questions, some have been answered in our lifetime. Well, or maybe a couple lifetimes before us. But some will be answered in the future. Like, I think Interstellar will be answered in the future. I don't know about Inception. I'm not really sure about that.
No, that seemed a little little too... Well, we can talk about Inception
this has
later.
This has been answered in... I keep stuttering, sorry. This has been answered in our lifetime. Maybe in lifetime past as well. In the DSM-5, whenever that came out. So anterograde amnesia. But Nolan does a really good job with these types of films. These what-ifs. These... we've said it so many times, but these math equations. And I really, really stay on the edge of my seat with all of these films. How do you think it compares?
Compares to his other movies? Yeah, I would put this up as one of my absolute favorites. It's a tough line with Nolan for me right now, because I really, really liked Oppenheimer when it came out. But I'm also, at the same time, I'm thinking in the back of my mind, you know, this movie just came out. I need to revisit in like a year and see what I still think of it. Like, is it worth the 5 stars that I gave it? But then I think about some of the scenes and like some of the ways it's shot, and I'm like, no, that is a really amazing movie. And then, but it's so different from this movie, because Memento, which I also have given 5 stars, and I just continued on this time around, still giving it 5 stars. And there's really no movie like this. Now, Nolan has definitely played with time again, and other movies, but there's something so neat about how small of scale this movie is.
True.
That you don't get in a lot of the more modern Nolan movies. Even the actors are like people who are like not quite A-listers. Carrie Ann Moss.
Is Guy Pearce not an A-lister?
No, no. I mean, he never quite broke into that, like Leonardo DiCaprio.
Oh, Brad, no. Pitt. I mean, breaking into that, there are like only three people up there.
Yeah. He's definitely a big actor, and he's been in important stuff. Same with Carrie Ann Moss. She was in The Matrix. But it's like, that's the kind of actor that brings the sort of grittiness to this movie.
Was this the Reservoir Dogs of
Nolan? You don't get like the grittiness of Memento in a lot of his other more like sleek thrillers that he has nowadays.
So it
This is a really gritty movie. Like the hotel rooms, the town, just everything about it. And that's what I like about it, combined with the fact that I think this is one of his tightest plots and most well executed plots, because he doesn't get too out of his depth with ambition like maybe he did in Tenet.
Yeah. I think so.
And maybe Inception, like. But at the same time, it's like, you know, The Dark Knight's really good. You know, he's a very solid director. There's not too many holes. Even Insomnia, which is kind of a more straightforward movie for Nolan, is like an actual really good thriller. Like, I would watch that over like many movies. So I think I would rank Memento and Oppenheimer up in the top two. And from there, I really like Dunkirk and Interstellar. So those are probably my next three or four, somewhere around there.
Yeah, I think I'd probably be pretty similar. I think my Oppenheimer's still my favorite. I wasn't just doing an emotional thing right after the film saying this was my favorite. I actually think I liked it a lot better. I also love Cillian Murphy a lot, so that probably played into it. I like him more than Leonardo DiCaprio, which also played into it. But it'd probably go, Oppenheimer, Interstellar, this, Inception.
Yeah.
And then the rest. I just call them the rest.
The rest.
I haven't seen The Following, so I'll have to get into that.
Following is very good. I will say that there was a point in his career where he's always sort of been a person who made thrillers or like noir movies. And then I think even Batman was like noir, really. I'm trying to think of his first non-crime, because Inception is kind of noir.
I didn't include Batman in my ranking just now, though.
You didn't?
No.
No. I mean, yeah, I didn't put The Dark Knight. I probably wouldn't put The Dark Knight in or any
you,
of that.
You wouldn't?
Movie. No, in my, not my top four.
Really? Okay. No.
Or Batman Begins.
We've been over this. That I like Batman Begins a little bit more. Let me redo it. Sorry. Oppenheimer, Batman Begins, Interstellar.
Okay.
Memento, Inception.
Yeah. I think Dunkirk is his first non-noir. So it's still interesting. Like, in all the things that he does, Oppenheimer was a biopic. Like, he still kind of does stick to a genre. It's just he does so many things with it that you forget about the fact that he's like, that's his home.
Is he done?
Anytime he doesn't, is he what?
Done?
Is he done directing? Oh, no, definitely not.
Okay. I haven't heard a single thing after
this. I mean, I haven't heard that it might be a while. Like, he could take his time with whatever he does next. But I don't think he's done. I don't think there's been any sign that. And any studio would try to do anything within their power to convince him that he's not done yet.
Okay, I have the correct answer in my head, but I'm going to ask you. What do you think would be the worst film for him to direct next? You can do it to your own liking.
I feel like there's something that would be really funny. What would he be like? Just terrible at doing?
Maybe not terrible. Like, I think he'd do a good job at anything. What would you be mad at if Christopher Nolan directs? I'll give you mine. Nolan directs the next Marvel movie.
That did cross my mind. I was trying to think of a different direction, but maybe given more time, I could come up with something. Okay. That was just like, but I would just come up with something random that would be like, why would he do that anyway?
What if he did a collab with another director? What would be the best?
That could be interesting. What if he Fincher and Tarantino?
No, that's not a bad.
Tarantino would be a bad mix. Fincher could do it.
Tarantino would overtake the other two.
Yeah. Fincher could definitely do something with him because he shares sort of the noir, the love for noir. Scorsese needs his own thing. He's not. Fincher and Nolan seem like the most similar to me. Like, they do things because of their like perfectionist kind of attitudes and their very clear love for cinematography and certain things.
Yeah,
and
Prisoners could almost be in the same category as this.
Well, that's Denis Villeneuve. He's also, he actually is probably the most similar to Nolan.
Would he do a good collab with Nolan, you think?
I think he would. Okay. I think you get Fincher, Villeneuve, Nolan.
What if Nolan did the next Dune with Villeneuve?
That would be interesting. It'd be interesting.
Dune 2.
I don't know why you would need both of them, though.
What if Nolan did 2 and Villeneuve did 3, or they did it together? I don't know. I'm just wondering.
I mean, it could be good. Could be good.
I'm just thinking, would Nolan go well with
it? I don't think Nolan... Well, I say Nolan doesn't need franchises, but he literally did Batman. But he also reinvented Batman in movie form. I'm sure he
could reinvent Captain
He took
Marvel.
Stuff off of comics, but he could reinvent Marvel. Yeah, maybe they needed Christopher Nolan
Captain
to do that.
Captain Marvel, yeah.
They need a grittier version of Marvel.
I heard in the Marvels there's a 10-minute musical scene.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Do you think Christopher Nolan ruined movies?
Blockbusters?
With the making the Dark Knight trilogy? Do you think that ruined movies?
Do I think he was a catalyst that led to that? Sure.
Yeah, but it wasn't his fault. Those are great movies.
Do you think his mom giving birth to him, do you think it's her fault as well? Like, we could go back.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point.
I think Christopher Nolan did a really good job. People took his work and saw how much money.
Yeah.
And tried to repeat.
Yeah, and they did to an extent.
Yeah. I mean, they made what, like $10 billion, almost 20?
I mean, they did make money, so.
Yeah.
If that's the measure of success, then we're all good.
Oh, definitely. I was thinking about this after I watched it. But are there any, I'm going to ask you first, are there any negatives to this film that you could say, like, I'm glad Nolan improved on this over the course of his career?
Did what?
Like, are there any things that Christopher Nolan has improved on with his subsequent movies?
Yeah. Maybe you could say he has improved on being able to take his concepts to bigger budget projects. Like, that is something that's like a transition, right?
Sure, but that's like you trying not to offend him. That's like an easy one.
Kind of.
You really think it's this good?
Do I think Memento is this good? Yeah, I think Memento is amazing.
Okay.
And I'm always... It's always a bit shocking when somebody's debut film is, like, so good. It's like, how did they come onto the scene as, like, a almost finished package?
Was this his debut?
It was his... This was not his debut, technically. Okay. I guess Following was his debut. And Following definitely is not a perfect movie by any means, so... But it was also shot on a much, much smaller budget, so...
Yeah, well, forgive my antagonism because I actually agree with you. I think it's declined.
He's like declined.
I think, well, it's declined.
I think I said that it was, he grew in terms of being able to take bigger concepts and turn them into movies. But I also think that he'll never be able to go back and make something like this ever again.
No.
Like, if he tried to make another Memento, I don't think it would work.
If he tried to make another Memento, Leonardo DiCaprio. Like,
Memento-sized movie.
And Denzel Washington would be in it, and it because, would be too much.
And it's almost because it would be destined to fail because of people's expectations. Oppenheimer was an amazing movie, but that movie was unworldly promoted as just the biggest spectacle you've ever seen in your life. And it, and really the way it was shot, how like frenetic it was, and the editing and the music and all of it, it was a spectacle. Mm-hmm. Like Memento has difficult editing to follow to some extent, but it's not like a spectacle that.
No, Oppenheimer's like, it feels like musical.
Yeah.
Like you walk out of it and you feel like you've been shown the story rather than you looking. You're not this is a weird way to say it. Like it's been spoon-fed to you at a nice rate. Even though the scenes go extremely fast and every single scene matters in Oppenheimer, and scenes don't even know what room you're in at some point. and it's very dense. But it feels like it's like a gentle, here's 1 million pieces of information, rather than Memento feels a little bit more.
You're lost. Like the first time you watch it, it's like, hello, this is happening.
Yeah, I'm not.
You don't know where you are.
I'm not being carried through a flower field of daisies, right? No. That's Oppenheimer, even though it's about killing millions of people.
And there's no Einstein cameos. Oh, it's Einstein.
He comes through the portal. But Memento is like you're dropped in a jungle and you got to figure out what's happening. It's more a little bit more hard cut, like you said, gritty. So I like the Crocodile Dundee aspect of that, but I don't think it has gotten better, if that makes sense. Yeah. I really like Memento, and I put it up there as my, fourth favorite?
Fourth or fifth favorite, yeah.
I'm specifically thinking of like Inception, Tenet, some of the ones that are a little bit more famous besides Interstellar. I really like that one, but that's because I personally love Relative
Tenet. Theory. Was the one that people like more agreed was like a misstep.
Okay.
And it wasn't because the concept wasn't cool. It was just because it was like lifeless. And that's been and we have not really talked about this, and this would be an interesting thing to maybe kind of close on, unless you had any other thoughts, is that in this movie, does it feel like the characters have more, like, things matter? There's more stakes to the actual characters themselves.
It's his wife that's been attacked.
It's his wife. And that's what I thought when I watched the movie initially compared to other movies. Even Inception, which, granted, I haven't seen in a while, so maybe I have to go back in. There's, like, connections with his wife and stuff, but there's still this, like, the characters feel not, they don't feel, like, connectable. And in some of his movies, it doesn't matter that the characters don't feel connectable.
Who remind me? Washington did.
Denzel Washington or John David Washington?
Yeah, John David,
his son.
Yeah, but I don't know if it was the script or not. It just didn't work as well.
That you cannot connect to those characters, and they didn't give you anything to connect. Like I always say, it's like I think I heard someone say this. It's like a Lincoln commercial. Like it's like all props. It doesn't feel like anybody's actual life. The dreams in Inceptions didn't feel like dreams that people would have, normal people would have, or anybody would have. You're like, they're in a cliff. They were really cool, but I'm like, this isn't a dream.
This is going to sound weird, but like Guy Pearce trying to take his pants off and his hands shaking, and like you see his thigh with these rugged tattoos that are bad handwriting, that feels more real. You're right.
Yeah.
Maybe there's a reality to his early filmmaking that has degressed over the years.
Yeah,
is that what you're trying to relate?
It's because he's always been a more conceptual, like plot-based director, and that's only increased because he's trying to pull off even more complex plots. Oops. I mean, Interstellar was an insanely complex thing to try to pull off. Like most of the plots he's done, even Dunkirk was like kind of a strange.
Have you studied Plato? Like his World of Forms?
Not
there's like this ideal world out there that Plato says, like there's a perfect chair.
This, yeah,
like that feels like Nolan's later movies, but the actual chair in real life that has a crack in it is that, you know, big guy sat on. Mm-hmm. That's what this film feels like. I prefer this. I prefer this less polished look to his film. But I really liked Oppenheimer because it is so different. It's just a biopic. I love history. I loved the cameos of the different Avengers, and it was amazing. So
yeah.
And yeah, then definitely. Interstellar, I mean, I have personal reasons to like, but I think the styling in this film I like better. I like that he didn't stick to a big, clean, clear, polished, waxed, and expensive concept. So yeah, maybe that's a good way to end it right there. I'd watched this one more time. What was this, the third time you've seen this?
This might be like the second and a half time I've seen it. I feel like one time I watched it, like half of it, and then stopped watching it. So I don't know.
I'm wondering if he...
Because there was parts I didn't remember. I was like, oh yeah, this happened. I forgot about that.
I'll be curious to watch Tenet and see if he used some of the same tropes. Because I mean, you know, the backward storytelling, that's pretty similar.
I need to rewatch Inception too. It's been actually a long time since I've watched that movie.
Yeah. Who's the best lead in all these films?
In all of Nolan's films? I might have to go with Cillian Murphy.
Yeah, Cillian Murphy.
Cillian Murphy.
Did awesome.
Yeah. It was amazing. Amazing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sorry, John David Washington.
Heath Ledger obviously gets a shout, but he's not really a
lead. He's not a lead.
He's a lead.
People say he's a lead, you know. People will say, like, legit.
But he was not. Percentage-wise in that movie, it was more that he maximized the screen time that he was in.
Who was designated the lead? The first actor on the list in the credits?
It's Christian Bale.
Exactly.
Yeah. He was great. So, I mean, I liked Christian Bale.
Yeah, he's good.
But
he's really good.
I think McConaughey in Interstellar was really good.
Yeah.
He's a sort of sentimental favorite. I think
he had a lot of heart for
a Nolan movie. I feel like McConaughey had a lot of heart.
It's just hard for me to see McConaughey, and I mean, he does well in the film, but he's like more of a country guy for me. Seeing him in this science-y space film is weird for me.
Yeah, I could see that.
You know, he's got the long hair. He seems like a guy that would ride a horse in a white coat.
Exactly.
So not a doctor coat, but yeah. So yeah, what was your favorite part
This movie? Mm-hmm. I love the end where he says, I have to believe in a world outside my own mind. I have to believe that my actions still have meaning, even if I can't remember them. I have to believe that when my eyes are closed, the world's still there. Do I believe the world's still there? Is it still out there? Yeah. We all need mirrors to remind ourselves who we are. I'm no different. Mm-hmm. It's just like, I remember that scene just like really hitting me at the end of the movie when I realized like the weight of everything that had happened. Cause even when you see him kill the guy at first, you don't know what is happening. And in the middle of the movie, you're like, you still are kind of lost on what you should think of Lenny. And you read this quote and you're like, I kind of interpret it as like, this guy is somewhat choosing to still be on this path of revenge. And this is his way of saying like, we all need mirrors, but he's kind of also saying like, we all need to deceive ourselves into having a purpose. So maybe that's not like it's not a lesson you're supposed to take away and be like, that's how I'm supposed to live my life. It's more of like, you look around, and you're like, how many people are living their lives in this way?
Well, no, that's not Nolan's style. We're not supposed to bomb millions of people.
Yeah.
I think it's almost like the top spinning.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
It's that quote seems like that. It seems like a trope that he follows pretty clearly. I think my favorite part was Teddy's photo.
Yeah, Teddy's photo. I was going to say, the interactions between Teddy and Lenny are pretty funny. Yeah,
remind me, Teddy.
Joe Pantoliano.
And who has an award for him?
So the Ringer, the Rewatchables podcast, they have an award every episode. It's called the Joey Pants Award.
Yeah.
And I believe is it for that guy?
And his name is Joey Pantoliano?
Yeah.
And they call it the Joey Pants Award?
Yeah, it's like short for him. Okay. Award. Let's see if I can make sure I got it right for what. It's in honor of a recognizable actor, a character actor that you'd recognize in a ton of TV movies, but you wouldn't necessarily know their name. Like,
wow.
So it's like for Joey Pants. It's funny because he's actually also in The Matrix as a, like a side character
with Carrie-Anne Moss,
so there's that. But he's just like a character actor who's just in a ton of movies, but he's never like, there's typically, if it's a big movie, it's not gonna be like Joe Pantoliano as like the lead character.
Who would get the Joey Pants award in this film
other than Joey Pants? I think the Rewatchables give it to Joey Pants.
I think Joey Pants would get this award
too. yeah he actually would. I mean, I'm sure some of these other guys, the guy in the lobby, he looked familiar.
Oh, Steven Tobolowsky?
No.
That's Sammy.
Sammy, I'm talking about.
Oh, the clerk.
The clerk.
Oh yeah. No, he seemed pretty recognizable.
Mark Boone Jr. He was also in Batman Begins. That's probably where I recognize him from. Yeah.
Okay.
He's in Sons of Anarchy, which I've never watched, but that makes sense that he's in that.
I mean, there are only, what, 5 characters in this film? So.
Yeah, there's not too many.
But anyway, is there anything you'd like to get off your chest?
Not really.
Okay. My chest burns with secrets, but I must keep them.
And on that note, we should have recorded this episode where we, like, started and stopped and, like, edited it so, like, it was backwards. We could still do that, I guess.
Didn't we do that for Tenet?
We probably tried to do something weird. That just sounds like too much work, though.
Well, Tenet was like our 3rd film.
I'm not. Yeah, Tenet was really early. Wow. It was like 7 or something, but yeah.
Wow.
That was COVID days. We were like the only people in the theater watching it.
Oh, yeah. That was like right before they started shutting down theaters, right?
Yeah. Or it was like they had reopened theaters for like a brief second. And Nolan had like pushed it back because he was like, you have to see my movie in theaters. You have to. That was also not great.
Oh, because that was late 2020.
Yeah, that was also not great for that movie in terms of its success, probably.
Correct, probably. Yeah, COVID film. Oh, well. Nolan, pick your years better. That's what I would say.
You got to predict when the next pandemic's coming so you don't release your movie then.
Yeah. Anyway, maybe he'll make a COVID movie. If he made a COVID movie, that would be so annoying.
That would be the only COVID movie I'd be kind of excited about watching. Because he could do it at least a little bit.
Adam McKay already tried it. I don't trust these directors.
Fauci
that I like.
Biopic?
Yeah. Gosh. It's so funny. I love, this is just me being stupid, but I love that a Fauci documentary came out in 2020. Like 5 months.
He was involved in it.
Yeah.
It was crazy.
It was like during, it was like, I remember like it coming on Disney Plus. And I was like, oh, a Fauci documentary. Is this about the HIV AIDS epidemic? No, it's about COVID, which came out fresh off the
I liked how people were already like honoring people as heroes before the thing had even ended. Yeah. They were like, yeah, this person's great.
This guy's a hero. Like, what do you mean? He's just now getting to work. It's been 3 months, you know? I just remember that coming out and me being like, these documentary people are like on it so fast.
Like, they're some of the fastest people in the industry.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, shout out to Dr. Fauci. Shout out to you, Anthony.
Yep. What a career.
Tim Dillon's Fauci, his kids, Fauci's kids impressions. I'm Tony Fauci. Anyway. All right. Well, close the vault. Whatever. Yep. Sometimes we run out.